southern suburbs, while its artillery fire also hit several towns and villages in southern Lebanon. The attacks killed and injured a number of civilians. Israel frequently conducts airstrikes in Lebanon despite a ceasefire agreement that was signed in November of last year. The regime has defied calls to adhere to obligations under the agreement, including the withdrawal of its forces from southern Lebanon. The United States has carried out fresh acts of aggression against Yemen to force the Arab country to stop its naval operations in support of Palestinians in Gaza. In their latest aggression, American warplanes conducted 15 raids on several areas in Saada governance in northern Yemen. The country's media reported 5 other American strikes targeting the Jarban area south of the Yemeni capital Sana'a. American aircrafts also conducted 2 air raids on the Bani Matar district west of Sana'a. The main target of U.S. attacks on the Yemeni capital have been civilian buildings. Washington claims attacks are meant to protect freedom of navigation in nearby waters. Yemen, however, rejects the claim, saying its naval operations solely target Israel-linked ships in an attempt to stop the regime's genocide in Gaza.
Over 3 weeks of daily U.S. airstrikes across Yemen have failed to achieve their declared goals of ending the Yemeni blockade against Israeli shipments in the Red Sea. When the Trump administration first launched its military operations, they confidently claimed the strikes would just last a few days. But upon entering the war with Yemen, Trump discovered what many had learned before him. Starting a war in Yemen is easy. Escaping its endless trap is where the real fight begins.
These U.S. airstrikes against innocent Yemenis and against Yemen came with the goal to protect and secure Israel and to stop Yemen from its support for Palestine. They have failed to achieve this main task. The biggest proof for this is that Yemen continues to attack Israel and has even expanded its operations targeting Ben-Gurion Airport and forcing it to close along with attacking more Israeli sites.
And that's because Yemen is constantly developing and manufacturing more advanced weapons at a record speed. According to military experts in Yemen, this accelerated development is baffling American military planners and reshaping battlefield calculations.
Today, Yemen's armed forces have acquired superior military means across the board, weapons that can hit with more precision and hit at greater distances against U.S. targets. This is changing the balance of power in this war in favor of the Yemeni people and the axis of resistance.
As Washington scrambles for answers, Yemen isn't just withstanding the assault, it's rewriting the rules of the battle. According to Yemen's defense minister, the armed forces have made significant progress in developing new weapons, which could soon be used to target additional U.S. positions on both land and sea. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
While Israeli forces continue to pound the Gaza Strip with air and artillery strikes, killing and injuring more Palestinian civilians across the besieged territory. At least 10 civilians, including children and women, were killed after a house was bombed in the Al-Tufah neighborhood of Gaza City. Another strike targeted a group of people in the Al-Burayj refugee camp in central Gaza, killing 5 people. A woman and a child were also killed following an Israeli airstrike on displaced persons' tents west of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Palestinian journalist Mohammed Saleh Al-Bardawil was killed along with his wife and children after their home was bombed west of Khan Yunis. According to Gaza's health ministry, the regime strikes have killed at least 80 Palestinians and injured over 300 others over the past 2 days alone. Since Israel restarted its onslaught on Gaza on March the 18th, the regime's attacks have killed over 1,000 civilians while injuring over 2,300. The overall death toll from the Israeli genocide now exceeds 50,300, with over 114,400 others injured. A foreign student fearing abduction and repression has left the United States as Trump's cabinet intensifies crackdown on pro-Palestine protests across the country's universities. In a statement, Mahmoudou Tal announced that he is leaving the U.S. after his visa was revoked. The Cornell University student stressed that he believes he can no longer walk the streets without fear of being abducted. He also said immigration agents had been sent to his home, and his initial legal challenge to prevent detention was rejected. The Trump administration has ramped up revoking visas of pro-Palestine activists without even a notice, prompting fears of freedom of speech in the U.S. Earlier in March, a Tufts University student, Rumesia Ozturk, was detained by a group of masked agents as she was walking to meet her friends. According to the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, more than 300 visas have been revoked so far. Clashes have broken out in the occupied El Quds between Israeli forces and demonstrators who called on the regime to stop attacking Gaza and agree to a ceasefire deal to secure the release of all captives held there. The protesters denounced handling of the Gaza war by the cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and repeated violations of the ceasefire deal. They warned that returning to war in Gaza would sacrifice their loved ones, stressing that military pressure cannot save the captives. The protesters also slammed the regime's efforts to dismiss the head of Shin Bet and the attorney general, who are opposed to Netanyahu. Local sources reported that the clashes erupted as protesters attempted to breach security barriers near the Knesset. The new rally followed a surge in demonstrations throughout the week across the occupied Palestinian territories. The weekly protests revealed the rising dissent against Netanyahu's cabinet over the resumption of the onslaught on Gaza. Israeli occupation forces continue with their aggressive operations across the occupied West Bank, intensifying military raids, detaining civilians, and attacking Palestinian communities. Israeli forces have ordered residents of Jabal al-Salahin on the outskirts of Nur Shams refugee camp to evacuate their homes amid an ongoing military operation. The troops have also reportedly set fire to several homes within the camp, conducting continuous house raids and destroying infrastructure, displacing even more residents. Earlier, regime forces raided a Palestinian home in Salem, east of Nablus, assaulted the family members, and ransacked their property. Israeli forces also detained a journalist and a citizen from the town of Beita, south of Nablus. Meanwhile, in Jericho, Israeli troops stormed the Bedouin community, damaging Palestinian property and terrorizing the residents. Our Ramallah correspondent, Nakat Hamad, joined us earlier to bring us up to speed on the latest Israeli crimes across the occupied West Bank. Let's take a listen.
The situation impacts every Palestinian over here, as the IOF is continuing their aggression upon Palestinian cities. Let's start from Tul Kerem, where until the hours of the early morning, the IOF continued evacuating many Palestinian families, forcibly evacuating, of course, many Palestinian families from inside Nur Shams refugee camp, specifically to the area of Jabal al-Salihin. These families are adds up to more than 25,000 other forcibly displaced Palestinians from inside Nur Shams refugee camp, adding up to the total number of the displaced Palestinians in the northern part of the West Bank, up to 65,000 Palestinians have been forcibly displaced out of their homes. Of course, setting the houses on fire, this is something that we are seeing more and more, so that even if there is some kind of agreement or some kind of truce happens in the those refugee camps, the people, the Palestinian families, wouldn't find any homes or any place to go back. This is a major point that is being worked on over here in the West Bank, that the IOF, the Israeli regime, has decided to forcibly expel Palestinians out of the West Bank.
Iran commemorates the 45th anniversary of establishing the Islamic Republic on the back of a historic referendum, in which Iranians voted overwhelmingly in favor of departure from Iraqi rule. In a landmark referendum held in 1979, more than 98.2% of eligible Iranians voted yes to establishing an Islamic Republic in the country. The vote, which was held less than 2 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, is considered as a turning point in the modern history of Iran. The Islamic Republic was established in Iran in line with the popular motto of the 1979 Islamic Revolution that called for independence, freedom, and the Islamic Republic for the country. Since then, the nation annually celebrates April 1st on the Iranian calendar as the Islamic Republic Day. The Islamic Revolution, led by the late Imam Khomeini, culminated in the overthrow of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in February 1979. China has launched a large-scale naval and air exercises around Taiwan, which Beijing says are aimed at simulating a blockade. Taiwan's Defense Ministry released footage showing Chinese warships and aircraft encircling the island, prompting Taipei to dispatch its own forces and deploy land-based missile systems in response. The ministry reported that the presence of 19 Chinese warships near its waters in the 24 hours leading up to the drills. The exercises included sea-air combat patrols, assaults on maritime and ground targets, and blocking key areas and sea lanes. Beijing said the drills were a stern warning and forceful deterrent against separatist forces. Taiwan Defense Minister stated the island's armed forces were closely monitoring Chinese military activities and movements.
Today, of course, they announced the joint naval and air exercises this morning, but we will also pay attention to their related developments, not just the one that is currently underway, but also the start of the joint combat readiness military training. Of course, we will also pay attention to the movement of the Shandong carrier group off Taiwan's southeastern, and also the movement on land.
The defense minister added that China's actions damage the peace and stability of the region. Taiwan's armed forces have set up a response center to monitor Chinese military activities after Beijing announced exercises around the island. The large-scale drills come amid rising tensions as China asserts its claim over Taiwan, with a self-governed island demanding sovereignty while counting on U.S. support and military aid. China, however, has warned that efforts towards independence for Taiwan would mean war. Well, now joining us from Beijing is Mr. Inar Tanjin, founder and chairman of Asia Narratives. I'd like to thank you very much, Mr. Tanjin, for joining us. I do actually have to ask you, I mean, over the past week, the U.S. has continued to reiterate its support for Taiwan, bolstering even its hopes of increased military aid, high-level diplomatic engagements, and even emphasizing its commitment to Taiwan's security and stability in the region. Has this escalated a narrative actually pushed Beijing to carry out these large-scale naval and air exercises around Taiwan that we are seeing now, Mr. Tanjin?
To go back a little less than a week ago when Li from Taiwan called Beijing a, quote, foreign hostile force, unquote. It's a very specific phrase from the 2020 Anti-Infiltration Act. The phrase, according to the wording of the act, applies to countries, political entities, or groups that are at war with or engaged in military standoff with the Republic of China, that being Taiwan. So this is how it started. Of course, Hegseth and the crew there were very anxious for any topic other than the breach of security that they were involved in. And they have been throwing platitudes towards Taiwan, as well as Hegseth getting out of Washington and coming to the east to rally Japan. And Japan has also been playing ball. It's very clear that Donald Trump has changed everything in terms of the economic, political, military calculus, and people are trying to gauge where that stands, and we'll have to see how that comes about in the next few months.
Well, exactly. Mr. Tanjin, as you did mention, the Donald Trump administration has definitely changed a lot. And at the end of the latest report, it says that China has warned that efforts towards independence for Taiwan would mean war. With what we have been seeing since Donald Trump did take over his presidency, I mean, do you believe that the Donald Trump administration will indeed support Taiwan if it did lead to war?
No, I don't think that Donald Trump particularly cares at all about Taiwan, except as a card. The only thing that Taiwan has that he cares about is chip-making facilities, and he now believes that these facilities will be built in the United States. But he's not anxious for any war at this point. But he does like the idea of trying to put kind of all-around pressure on Beijing to kind of halt or contain its economic rise. This is the main issue for Washington, is how do you deal with China, because the Washington refuses to give up its global hegemony.
Yes, well, I'd like to thank you very much, Mr. Enor Tangen, founder and chairman of Asia Narratives, joining us there from Beijing. A pleasure to have you with us. Political divisions fester in the West as far-right politicians on both sides of the Atlantic rage against a court's decision, barring the French far-right leader Marine Le Pen from the 2027 presidential elections. U.S. President Donald Trump compared Le Pen's conviction to his own U.S. legal battles, stressing that the opposition parties are trying to ban the leading candidates, just as they try to do with him. Trump's billionaire ally and cabinet member Elon Musk has also denounced the move, saying that it will backfire. Meanwhile, in Europe, Hungarian nationalist leader Viktor Orban expressed his solidarity with a French politician by posting "I'm Marine" on social media. The Kremlin, former Brazilian leader Jair Bolsonaro, and Le Pen's National Rally Party also slammed the sentence for violating democracy. Le Pen received a 4-year prison sentence and a 5-year ban on running for office for embezzling European Parliament funds and employing assistants who were working for her party. Well, thank you very much. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is Arabi English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir. iranradio.ir.
Islamic Republic Day. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The Islamic Revolution in Iran triumphed on February 11, 1979, less than 2 months after this greatest event of the 20th century. Imam Khomeini called on people to take part in a referendum to determine the type of the system of government. Therefore, on 30th and 31st of March, the nationwide referendum was held and over 98.2% of the participants voted yes to Islamic Republic as the ruling system in the country. Thus, April 1st was named as the Islamic Republic Day in the Iranian calendar. This way of determination and formation of the ruling system has not had any precedent in history, even in the so-called democratic societies in the West. In view of the fact that the Iranian nation is a Muslim nation and had struggled for Islam for decades, especially with the leadership of Imam Khomeini, some officials and analysts maintain that there was no need to hold a referendum, but the Imam insisted on a clear and public referendum. The founder of the Islamic Republic said in his message to the Iranian nation, "This referendum will determine the fate of our nation. This referendum will either draw you to freedom and independence or, like before, to suffocation and dependence on others. This referendum is what everyone should participate in it. You can choose any form that you want. You have the right and you're able to write on this paper, democratic republic, royal regime, or whatever you want. You are free in this." On this great day, the faithful Iranian people demonstrated their national unity and Islamic solidarity with their decisive vote to fortify the bases of the Islamic Revolution. They altered the history of mankind with their faithful election. The Iranian people dismantled a long history of despotism, oppression, and disgraceful colonialism for good. The Islamic Republic has been the most democratic system of government in the past centuries, far superior to the democratic rule which has been claimed and propagated for decades by higher thinkers and writers in the West. The Islamic Republic is built up of two parts, Islam and people. That's why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, insists of calling it religious popular rule rather than the man-made flawed Western democracy, which has proved its deficiency and even contradiction with the votes of people. The establishment of the Islamic Republic not only proved the Iranian nation's will on their fate, but it also inspired hope in the hearts of the oppressed and downtrodden in the world. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, called April 1st as a feast and said in a message, "The morning of April 1st, which is the first day of Allah's rule, is one of our greatest religious and national feasts. Our nation should hold on this day as feast and keep it alive." Ayatollah Khamenei also said, "There is another feature in our Islamic Republic Day, namely, it is not the feast of us, the Iranian people. Rather, it can be the feast of all those who are Muslims. It means nearly 1 billion people. They, meaning the Muslim nations, have also got used to seeing Islam in the state of defense and passive position, in the state of isolation. When a nation stands in the position of attacking domineering powers and aggressive, incomplete man-made systems and proclaims a republic on the basis of Islam, this is a cause of boasting and honor for Muslim nations. In short, there are various features in the Islamic Republic Day." Clearly, Finally, the formation of the Islamic Republic system in Iran created a new theory among the political theories of the East and the West. Article 56 of Iran's constitution reads, "Absolute rule over the world and human being belongs to God, and it is He who has made human being ruler of his social fate. Nobody can dispossess human being of this divine right or put it at the service of the interest of a special individual or group. And the nation wields this God-given right in the ways that will come in the next articles." The establishment of the Islamic Republic system in Iran, besides domestic developments, caused different changes in the region and the world, which were not compliant with the unholy goals of the colonialist powers. In view of this, the enemies of Islam and the Iranian nation hatched various plots to topple this system. These plots began since the first days of the victory of the Islamic Revolution and escalated after the formation of the Islamic Republic. They included the imposition of an 8-year war, assassination of political, religious, and revolutionary figures and officials, economic sanctions, creation of barriers on the way of achieving peaceful nuclear energy, assassination of scientists of nuclear field and commanders of the resistance front, and kindling riots in a number of cities. Now, the Islamic Revolution has already started the second phase of its life. The leader of the Islamic Revolution says, "Why has the Islamic Republic not suffered the destiny of other systems and revolutions despite this much of enmity? What is the reason and the mystery? I tell you that the splendid and honorable mystery of this system and the durability of this system are these two words, Republic and Islamic. The accompanying of these two words with one another, and the creature that has been formed of these two words, should naturally be permanent. Both the Republic and the Islamic, people and Islam. Republic means people, and Islamic means Islam, religious popular rule. The feat of our great Imam was that he created this thought, this theory. The theory of the Islamic Republic brought it among various political theories, as in that era, different political theories were in contact with each other in the East and the West in the field of political issues and political mentalities. He materialized it, realized it. It was not merely the creation of a theory, but he materialized it and created the Islamic Republic system. This was the Imam's feat."
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone.
Now, the holy fasting month of Ramadan for Muslims is a month during which many traditions are observed, from introspection to strengthening familial and community ties onto charity and other acts of kindness. Upon conclusion of the holy month, there's a day of celebration called Eid or Aid. Eid or Eid al-Fitr or Eid al-Fitr is a day of love and giving, of celebration, joy, cherishing family and community. So what do you think the last two Ramadans were like for the Palestinians of Gaza, or the last two Eids? How do you celebrate while mourning your loved ones, while hungry, broken, displaced, and traumatized? And while the Israeli occupation bombs continue raining down all around you, leaving you with no safe place to celebrate or mark this occasion, this is a topic of tonight's Spotlight program. And now, let's begin with a quick report.
Amid relentless Israeli bombardment, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza performed Eid al-Fitr prayers over the rubble of destroyed mosques in displacement shelters and besides the ruins of their homes. The destruction of homes and places of worship has left many Palestinians with nowhere to gather for Eid prayers, further deepening the sense of loss during this sacred time.
This Eid comes at a very depressing time and amid circumstances of death, starvation, and bombing. But the people in Gaza insist on celebrating Eid despite everything, even if it only means performing the Eid prayer.
Reviving the spirit of Eid is an attempt by the people of Gaza to momentarily escape the Israeli resumption of the genocide and the grave humanitarian crisis caused by the ongoing blockade. However, the Israeli occupation insists on staining this day in particular with bloodshed and massacres.
I only came to the Eid prayer to fulfill a religious duty. However, there is no joy or happiness for us. As you can see, the mosque is destroyed, but despite that, they cannot erase our faith from our hearts, and we must pray.
In the 24 hours leading up to the Eid, the Israeli massacre intensified, leaving at least 50 Palestinians killed, the majority of whom were young children playing close to the tents while dressed in minimally available Eid clothing.
This third Eid since the beginning of the genocide concludes with the sounds of the takbirs being mingled with the explosions of the artillery shells falling on the tents and the homes of the people, killing the children and burying their laughter under the rubble of their homes, and making this trip even a wider slaughterhouse. Ghad Ibrahim, Gaza City.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And now for our guests. Joining us is Sarah Flounders from the International Action Center out of New York. And Christopher Helali, researcher and political analyst, joining us out of Verchar, Vermont, U.S. as well. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Ms. Flounders, we'll start with you. Welcome to our Spotlight program. Pleasure to have you, ma'am. 80 people have been killed in the past 48 hours in Gaza through Israeli attacks, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, raising the number, overall number, since March 18th, when Israel completely put an end to its participation in the Gaza ceasefire, to now 1,001 in less than 2 weeks. Your opening thoughts, please, on this year's Eid al-Fitr massacre in Gaza by the Zionist entity.
Well, it is horrific. There's no other way to say it, and it is deliberate. And the Zionists keep careful track of every celebration and holiday and religious significance, and how to bring insult to it, how to use it to grind down the Palestinian people. Instead, they become more steadfast, stronger in their determination, but it is a real and systematic and continuing effort to insult the resistance and to try to break the resistance. It is totally backed by the U.S. in full support, knowing exactly what Ramadan means, and especially what Eid al-Fitr means throughout all of the Muslim world. And so to make insult, to make massacres on this day is very, very intentional. And I think the condemnations around the world are very important, but they don't end the crimes, because, as I say, there's total U.S. support for these crimes, and they even help to publicize it, because they're trying to send a message to the whole world that there's no crime they won't commit, no matter how disgusting or horrific.
Thank you, ma'am. And Christopher Hilali, welcome to the conversation there, bud. Good to have you. Christopher, the occupation could have very well stuck to the January 19th Gaza ceasefire agreement, which we should add Hamas completely respected throughout the first phase, and the entity, the occupation, never allowed it to reach the second phase. Your initial thoughts, please, on how this all could have been prevented, the Ramadan and Eid al-Fitr bloodshed in Gaza.
Well, first of all, Eid Mubarak to all of your listeners and to everyone in our Islamic community. Of course, these massacres are ongoing because, as rightfully pointed out by Sarah Flanders, the Zionists and their allies do not care about these holidays in terms of moments of celebration and unity, but to use them rather as days of bloodshed. And so we've seen the bloodshed in Gaza on these supposed to be most holy days, celebratory days at the end of the month of fasting. And we've also seen bloodshed in Yemen and Lebanon, where bombing has resumed by the Zionists and their allies. So, of course, this bloodshed could have totally been prevented had the Zionists and their allies in the West been committed to peace. But they're not committed to peace. They are committed to a path of war. They're committed to a path of genocide. They're committed to a path of domination in the region. And so what prospects of peace do we have if they are so committed to destroying any resistance to their access of domination on the region? That's the real concern, is how to overcome their stranglehold. And the only way to do that is through resistance. But as you can see, even resistance in words, even resistance, religious resistance, is met with brutal and barbaric acts such as the Zionists have committed in Gaza in recent days.
And Ms. Flounders, the way these the Eid massacres have unfolded, practically all civilians, many children, you see them wearing their deceased, their corpses draped in their Eid celebratory clothes. They're very extremely disheartening to see these images. And, you know, lives poignantly cut short, ma'am. And to your point, what is achieved from this deliberate, systematic onslaught of this level of barbarism on these kind of special holidays?
Well, I think what's shown, what's exposed to the whole world, and what was shown on that signal chat of the war makers planning their bombing of Yemen is just how absolutely ruthless they are, and how much these attacks are intended to strike the most defenseless in order to send a message of ruthlessness. There's no other message that they want to send. Clearly they know that there's no way to respond to such crimes, and particularly the striking of children. I do find in all of this, the images you just showed of parents, even in the midst of rubble, they're pushing their children on swings. They're doing everything they can to help to bring joy when there is no joy, but to share with their children real, traditions, the meaning of this day. And that determination does give confidence to the world of just how steadfast the Palestinians are and how steadfast the entire axis of resistance is. So while the U.S. and the Zionists may be intending one message, the message that's absorbed by the people of the whole world, by people of conscience everywhere, is an entirely different message, that it takes continued determination to survive this level of brutality. And that's a very important message, because they want to say there's nothing we won't do unless you bow down and accept complete ruin. And clearly the Palestinians are saying, as Chris very rightfully is saying, they refuse. They refuse, and that is the message I think we need to draw, to continue every effort. And just thinking of the past days and the coming days, there's one demonstration, one rally after another here on El Quds Day on Friday, who are out in force, and on Land Day, on Sunday, and on every one of these days, there is actions, there's protests, there's arrests, there's young students facing deportation on no grounds except that they spoke out. So I think our message needs to, in every way, reflect the determination we see, and to stand wholeheartedly with Palestine and with resistance during this entire period and into the future.
And Christopher, imagine bombing and killing an entire family. We saw it last night, 9 people of a single family killed by an Israeli bomb. Imagine that happening not just on a holiday or under any circumstance in the States. If somehow the enemy bombs on Thanksgiving Day a family, or Christmas Day, a family sitting at their dinner table in Vermont, where you're at, or in New York. Imagine the kind of global pushback. And Ms. Sarah Flounders alluded to it earlier, that global condemnation is extremely important. Why are women and children's lives in Gaza not getting the coverage or the appeal or the uniform blanket condemnation that they deserve? Are their lives any less important for world leaders? Why are they not speaking up on this on these atrocities?
Regrettably, for the West, the lives and the blood of Palestinians is cheap. It's cheaper than the lives of those in the West. And that has been the case for many, many decades. In fact, some would say it's been the case since the beginning of this imperialist and colonialist onslaught on the region. And so when you see entire families wiped out, not only in these brutal massacres, these barbaric massacres now, but throughout the course of this genocide, we've seen entire families completely erased from history that have been there for millennia, and they're gone. And when you see that, and you see that there is limited outcry in the West, because, of course, it's the West that has imposed this brutality upon the people of the region. It is the West that supports the Zionist entity, that created it to begin with, and imposes its will upon the Palestinian people, who are the natives of that land. When you see all of this happening, you understand that for the West, there is no conscience, there is no moral or ethical values that are deep-rooted within them. There is only the value of dominance, the value of supremacy, and the value of conquest. So when all of that is added together, clearly it becomes apparent that they do not care about these Palestinian families, whether women or children, as you are rightly saying, in their festive attire for this most holy of celebrations. But what ends up happening is that their lives are devalued. They are equated with quote-unquote terrorism and things like that, when they are merely innocent children, 4, 5, 6 years old, at the age of some of my children. And so when you see that, it exposes the barbarity of the West. It exposes the fact that it has no leg to stand on. It has no more justification to speak about human rights. It actually never did, because it itself is the greatest purveyor of violence and violations of human rights around the world. So that is why we see the press in the global South speaking so much about what's happening in Gaza, speaking truth to power, especially the power of the global North. But of course, we don't see it as much in the West, because the West, of course, has its agenda and is also dominated by very powerful interests that continue to try to highlight the Zionist claims and the Zionist perspective, but not the Palestinians' claims and perspective, and the fact that they are the ones suffering under this brutality since October the 7th.
And Sarah Flanders, I also want to come back to you because you initially mentioned the importance of strong global condemnation. We heard it earlier today in a speech by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. He said that global unity is very important right now to push back against the Zionist onslaught and massacres against Palestinians, where we have yet to see it. And I just want to ask you, I mean, Israel has, I mean, isolated and ostracized over the past 18 months than it's been, possibly since its establishment, but not on the level, ma'am, that is warranted by this level of death and destruction and genocide in Gaza. Why?
A lot of it is the domination, the control of the huge corporate media that's owned by the billionaires. And I think we need to find new targets, new ways of explaining this reality. Just to give one example, tomorrow here in New York, we're having a march on Billionaire Row. This is the wealthiest zip code in the U.S. today, where really the multi-billionaires live. And it's a march for Gaza, saying, you know, that Gaza is for the Palestinians, not for the billionaires. That's what Trump proposed. Make it a resort. Just drive the people out. We need to respond to that. We need to respond again and again with ways of explaining and targeting who's responsible for these unspeakable crimes. Because solidarity really is the one weapon we have. Human consciousness and increasingly standing together in unity. This becomes very powerful, and it can't be pushed back as people understand it. Very important, the statements about the world coming together, because mm-hmm. that's what's happening. These actions are acts of total desperation. The Zionists, and also U.S. imperialism, frankly, is frantic that they can't stop this level of just sheer human resistance and will. So from here, I think we need to find new ways of expressing this, of encouraging those who are facing real repression right here now to stand firm. And as I say, we're going to do a march on Billionaire Row for Gaza, because that's who they want to steal everything from. And we need to answer that in real and living ways.
And good luck with that, Ms. Flanders. And Christopher, it seems throughout the years that the occupation has been extra provocative and aggressive when it comes to holy Islamic traditions and occasions and even sacred sanctities. We've seen every year through the holy fasting month of Ramadan, they've attacked worshipers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound or prevented them access to get into the compound. We've seen, on the flip side of that, settlers allowed into the compound to insult, to engage in inflammatory actions toward Palestinians there. To Sarah Flanders' point earlier, what is the point of the systematic policy of the Israelis to take these sacred times for the Muslims, and it's not just Muslims, I should add, and I'll bring that up later too, but sanctities, holy sanctities of the Palestinians, and try to degrade them on these occasions?
Well, of course, it is policy of the Zionist entity there to not only target Muslim holy sites and holy days and days of prayer and fasting, but also Christian sites. And we've seen this, that Palestinian Christians and Muslims are united in their oppression by the Zionist entity. We've seen it with various churches in Al-Quds, in Jerusalem, belonging to Armenians and other Palestinian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox Christians. And we've seen the level of depravity and escalations by not only the Zionist regime, but by settler, you know, far-right settler groups that are now instilling fear in local sheikhs, in Islamic leaders, in the worshipful and the faithful, and also with priests and different other communities in the region. So this is done to not only target these communities, but to humiliate them, and to basically emphasize realize that they are not welcome in the land that they have known as home for millennia, that they are not welcome anymore, and that this is part of the ongoing supremacy of the Zionists, and that this land is only for one group of people and for nobody else. And it's meant as a humiliation, not only for the people of the locales, of the region, but for the wider Islamic world, for the wider world of Christians as well, who are also, especially Orthodox Christians, who are facing this type of repression within the Zionist-controlled areas. So that's a big cause for concern, because it affects the religious sentiments of many people, and it shows the gross violations of human rights and human dignity of people to worship freely, to go to their places of worship in peace, and to protect those places of worship from the encroachments of these groups that seek to not only stop the prayers there, but in the case of the Al-Aqsa compound, to take it over, to destroy it, and to rebuild the third temple for a very fringe far-right group that has grown in dominance in the Zionist entity.
Mm. And Ms. Sarah Flanders, I'd like to also end our conversation with just that, that this targeting of religious occasions and sanctities is not exclusive to Muslims. The discrimination, the disrespect. We saw Christmas. We saw settlers walking by, and the images were everywhere online, if you remember, settlers walking by the entrance and the walls of a church there in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, Old City, spitting on the wall, on the entrance. And then when the father came out, Father Nicodemus Schnabel, he was about to engage with a reporter when he was accosted by two settlers who insulted him, spit on him, and kicked him. Now, it may be shocking, these things happen, and I'm sure they happen everywhere, but we never see people with this kind of mindset receive endless weapons and political cover to remain this backwards and this repulsive anywhere on the planet, do we?
No, there's almost, it's hard to imagine anything that would match this level of actual fascist training in the IDF forces. They're really trained in the most provocative, disgusting, offensive, racist, abusive ways, trained to target children, trained to target religious symbols. Now, here's the real contradiction, even here in the U.S. today, and that is every politician elected to office will back up this war, Republican or Democrat. People thought, oh, Biden wasn't doing enough. They had some expectation it would be better with Trump. Huh. The whole government system is totally aligned with imperialist war, and yet, in every poll, the majority of the population here in the U.S. is sympathetic to Palestine. But of course, their voices aren't heard, don't count. And the problems are becoming so great here that it attempts to push away any awareness of the world. And yet, that's got to be our continuing and deep concern. So these contradictions will come back and haunt the U.S. empire. They will, because it's lessons are being learned even by the population here as their life difficulties increase. Who are our friends? Who are our allies? And where we have to stand against this government that on every level is criminal and stealing the resources right from here to pay for more and more war and humiliation. I think we have to make those links every single day in every message that we put out. Who benefits, which is the billionaires and the war makers, and who pays for these crimes. So saying no in organized and militant ways, I think, has to be on our agenda going forward, because the international organizations, beyond issuing statements, aren't doing much. And so there's a greater responsibility right here to answer to these attacks.
All right, very well. I want to thank the both of you for joining us on our Spotlight program. Stay safe to the both of you. Appreciate having you both on. Ms. Sarah Flanders there from the International Action Center joining us out of New York, and Christopher Hilali, researcher and political analyst from Verchères, Vermont. And this brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Yeah. Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Why there is a need for a government which will be established by the Wali of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
In one of the letters that he writes to Sheikh Mufid, he tells us one of the ways that we can end the ghibah.
Let us see how one can prepare for the advent of the zuhur of Imam Mahdi, Sahib al-Zaman.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam al-Mahdi, alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. Please stay tuned. The 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, is the one who brings hope to all of humanity. As the world is being grinded between the oppressors and tyrants of the age, we look towards the heavens so that the advent of the 12th divinely appointed Imam comes sooner. We raise our hands in prayers and we raise our hands in supplications, so that the awaited Savior of humanity comes and brings the final hope and salvation that humanity is so yearning for and desiring. The sights and the eyes of the world are looking towards the advent of this great Savior, Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance so that his eminence comes to establish the divine rule of the Almighty Allah for every single human being is completely dependent and needs this divine rule of the Almighty Allah. And it is this divine rule of the Almighty Allah, the kingdom of God that is to be established by Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, which will bring about ultimate justice in a world which is filled with cruelty and injustice. Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we are humbly speaking about the dialogues of the awaited Savior of humanity, the Master of the Age, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. This is a dialogue that Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, has with one of his close companions, Uthman ibn Sa'id. And so in this conversation and in this dialogue,
we find that Imam al-Mahdi reaches a point and His Eminence says that on the basis of this, that means this occultation that will happen, and of course